Case United States versus St. Julius et al.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Nicole DeBord, and I represent Leah St. Junius. Leah St. Junius was ignorant. There is no question that what occurred in this case is highly offensive. But the person who is most responsible pled guilty and accepted the blame early on, and that's James Reese. He cheated. James Reese cheated the government, he cheated his family, he cheated the patients, and he cheated Miss St. Junius. And it's normal to be really angry with Miss St. Junius for her negligence and stupidity because of the volume of fraud that occurred in this case. But that's the exact reason why the court should use extreme caution when giving a deliberate ignorance charge, which is the first issue that I would like to address with the court. One question that I think that the government simply cannot answer is, what did Ms. St. Junius do to purposefully avoid learning of the conduct? And I think that that's not a question that the government can answer, because there is no evidence in the record that she did anything to purposefully avoid learning of the conduct. And this is the second prong of the test which should guide the court in determining whether or not to give a deliberate ignorance charge.
You don't think the overall circumstances described, fair argument could be made, and for the period of time of her being there, she'd have a heightened awareness, shall we say?
In my opinion, keeping in mind that Ms. St. Junius had lived her entire life with James Reese, she is just seeing the same man that she saw every day growing up. And she goes to work, she does her clerical duties. Mr. Reese even testifies that he doesn't ever, at any point during this fraud, trust her to do anything with the business other than clerical duties. Although it was his intent to have her ultimately take over the business, he doesn't ever give her any additional responsibility because she's just not learning the information. And I think that his testimony, compounded with what we have heard about, you know, who did what and who had the most knowledge and who actually corresponded and communicated with Medicare, shows that she didn't actually have the knowledge at all. And in this case, the government tried to respond to that in their case by saying it's not that she didn't have the knowledge, she actually in fact knew. And the government put on a great deal of evidence and to try to show that she had actual knowledge of the situation. But the problem is, for the deliberate ignorance charge, it doesn't get us there. We still have to have the evidence that there was some purposeful contriving to avoid learning of the conduct. The government cites some cases which we believe can be distinguished from our situation. The government cites AGBA, which in that case, it shows that there was a conscious effort on the part of the defendant to ignore Medicare's rules. And the difference in our circumstance is that Mrs. St. Junius never knew what the rules were to ignore. She was simply
we get this charge a lot. The judges have given the pattern charge, and we have quite a fair number of cases where we've approved it. So the question is, do you say it's the factual distinction here that separates your client from our pretty broad case law that allows the district court to give the charge? Now, my recollection, where it's been disapproved, somebody's been fairly further removed, let's say, from the action than maybe here. But what's the singular, I mean, I know you disagree, but I mean, what do you say that just critically distinguishes her from lots of actors where we've approved it?
I think that she actually was just a clerk, and that distinguishes her from someone that, she's a manager in title, which goes to my second point, maybe running out of time to address the managerial role issue, but it kind of dovetails into the same questions, which are really, what did she really know? What managerial role, what supervisory role did she have? And that actually goes to the deliberate ignorance charge as well. And unfortunately, the court in this case actually singles her out, and I think that that is a problem as well, because it focuses on her and allows the jury in their anger to convict her of negligence, which is not what I believe this particular charge is intended to do. It's not meant to allow a jury to convict someone of a crime, especially as serious as this, on the basis of negligence. And I think that's what we just can't know whether the jury did in this case. Also, and I know that we're running short on time, I just wanted to point out that for the manager and supervisory role enhancement that she got of the three levels, I believe that the government can't prove any of the six factors, much less a few of the six factors, which would normally be required in order for the government to get this particular enhancement. And I know the judge gave it in this circumstance, but we don't believe, based on the evidence in either the PSI or the record, that it's appropriate, Your Honors.
Madam Clerk, give her 2 minutes. I actually thought you were going to start with the leader organizer rather than the deliberate indifference. So for my benefit, elaborate more on why you think she's not the leader organizer.
Specifically, the case law says that Gray says that title alone is not sufficient to determine that a person is a leader organizer. And really, she fits this hole with the round peg perfectly. She has been listed as the owner of the operation, but in reality, what we find out from the evidence, in fact, the government's own agent, I believe on the April 13th record on page 81, when the government asked the question in direct examination, was Leah St. Junius the owner of the operation? And the agent responds on paper. So I believe even the government's own witnesses believe that she was nothing more than the paper product of James Reese's fraud. And
didn't the form that she signed have disclosure on it that she knew wasn't true factually? I mean,
well,
this whole thing wouldn't have gotten launched if she hadn't sent in the application for the appropriate status.
And I think that that's a point that the government felt was extremely important. And it actually, this enhancement goes farther than that, beyond allowing the fraud to happen, which was kind of the argument that the government really stands on. They have to actually be responsible for organizing others and carrying out the crime. Just because they're an essential part or they're essential to the success of the fraud doesn't mean that they should get this enhancement paragraph. And that's actually a part of Litchfield, which is one of the cases that the government cites in their brief. So we really believe that the court should have then applied the seven factors to determine whether or not to give this enhancement. And when you apply those seven factors, you'll find that Ms. St. Junius doesn't fit into any of them well. And so basically, essentially, some of the things that the court typically looks to are recruitment of accomplices, which she never did, exercising of decision-making authority, which she certainly didn't have, the nature of her participation, which we believe was clerical, and the degree of her participation, again, is small.
All right. All right. Thank you, Mr. Boyd.
Thank you very much.
You deserve a lot of time, I believe. Mr. Hughes?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Craig Hughes. I represent the appellant, Devin Michael Spicer, in this case. In this case, the district court erred at sentencing when it held Mr. Spicer accountable for a loss amount of $1,560,249.05 as the loss calculation under Section 2B1.1 of the guidelines. In finding Mr. Spicer responsible for that amount in a sentencing hearing that took approximately 14 minutes, The result was that Mr. Spicer's base guideline sentence was enhanced by 16 levels, resulting in a significantly harsher sentence than he would have received otherwise. As this court has set forth in U.S. versus Sanders, it's required that when determining loss amount, the government has to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that the defendant had the subjective intent to cause the loss that is used to calculate his offense level. In this case, as Mr. Ward pointed out, I think it's important to note that Mr. Reese, the co-defendant, was the one, along with Ms. St. Junius, I recall, who was submitting the claims to Medicare. Mr. Spicer was not submitting claims to Medicare. Now, obviously, there's case law in this circuit that you look at the amount, that there's been discussion about the amount billed versus the amount paid, but in any event, Mr. Spicer was not the one who billed Medicare. Therefore, there is no evidence of his subjective intent to cause a loss of $1.5 million to Medicare. The government falls back on relevant conduct and claims that Mr. Spicer should be held responsible pursuant to the relevant conduct provisions of the sentencing guidelines in that he was engaged in a joint criminal enterprise with Mr. Reese. What the government fails to point out or to address is that it has to be shown more than there is a joint criminal enterprise. What has to be shown is that it was reasonably foreseeable that losses in the amount to which the defendant is held accountable would result. It's our position that the government was not able to show that it was reasonably foreseeable on Mr. Spicer's part that any information he may have provided to Mr. Reese to use to bill Medicare certainly wasn't reasonably foreseeable that he would bill in the amount of $1.5 million. Now, Mr. Spicer's sentencing counsel objected to the loss calculation at sentencing. Furthermore, he suggested an alternative, that being approximately $71,120 in loss, which was the total amount received from Mr. Reese. I think it's also important to note in determining this point as to the correct amount, the loss calculation, that Mr. Spicer was in fact acquitted, was found not guilty of count one, which was the conspiracy to commit health care fraud count, and that to hold him responsible for the entire amount billed by Mr. Reese, not by Mr. Spicer, would have the effect of nullifying the jury's verdict of not guilty. Now, I understand that the government has cited case law that the sentencing court can consider conduct outside of conduct related to acquitted counts. But in this case, the conduct, again, was that of Mr. Reese and not Mr. Spicer. If I may, I will briefly address the restitution argument. At sentencing, Mr. Spicer was held responsible for approximately $794,000 in restitution. The government has conceded that only those losses that resulted directly from the counts of conviction should be considered in determining restitution. And in this case, the counts of conviction were counts 18, 23, and 24, which were the anti-kickback counts. And that as a result, the loss of the restitution amount related to those counts was $653 and not the nearly $800,000 that was assessed at sentencing. And again, the government has conceded that Mr. Spicer is entitled to a remand as to that point. It's our position that he's also entitled to a remand on the issue of determining the loss amount. Briefly, with respect to the abuse of trust enhancement, the two-point enhancement, would simply point out that as the government concedes on, I believe it's page 146 of its brief, that Mr. Spicer did not submit the application to Medicare on behalf of Elite Care. There was no evidence that he exercised a managerial role with respect to the operation of Elite Care, or for that matter, the Mobility Store or the Reese Group. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, sir. Mr. Frizzell.
May it please the court, John Frizzell for Martha Ramos. I thought I'd address two issues that are intertwined, and those are the sufficiency of the evidence and the misstatement of the law made by the government during closing argument. As a threshold matter, I wanted to address the government's allegation in its brief that Ms. Ramos did not preserve the sufficiency of the evidence for review under de novo standard. The district court, when Ramos's counsel was making his Rule 29 motion to the substantive anti-kickback statute counts, interrupted counsel right in the middle of his Rule 29 statement. So it is unclear what specifically his ground would have been had he not been interrupted in the middle of his statement. And also, any elements that were challenged under his Rule 29 statement to count one of the conspiracy did not limit the basis of his Rule 29 statements to the substantive counts. Under Herrera and other case law from the circuit, the specific objections to specific counts only apply to those specific counts in reviewing whether or not the defendant has waived issues as to other counts. During closing argument, the government twice stated that the defendants did not have to know that receiving the commissions was illegal or that they weren't allowed to receive commissions. The willfulness intent requirement requires that the defendant have an intent to disobey or disregard the law. So although under the willfulness requirement, under this circuit's precedent and other circuits, and under the statute as it's been updated in 2010, the defendant does not need to know specifically what law he or she may be violating, she does have to have a bad intent, knowing that the or disregarding the fact that the conduct is unlawful. The case law from this circuit, as I read it, in Davis, that's cited in the brief, is that the defendant does not need to know specifically what statute they're violating, but they still do need to know that they're violating a law or they're disregarding the law. And here, unlike other cases where the kickbacks may be on their face a violation of law because of the circumstances, Agent Nixon in his testimony testified that it was Ms. Ramos's status as an independent contractor that made the commission payments, that brought the commission payments within the anti-kickback statute. If she had been an employee, they would have fallen within one of the safe harbor provisions. And therefore, her conduct, just the conduct itself, was not the type of conduct, as other cases have said, the 11th Circuit, I believe, the government cites an opinion where, well, kickbacks are just automatically, you know, they're wrong. But that doesn't really apply in a case like this, where it's the Ms. Ramos, the defendant's status as an independent contractor that made them illegal. If she had just been an employee, it would have fallen within the safe harbor provision. And the harm on the improper argument was that the evidence against Ms. Ramos was not overwhelming. She did not actively conceal fraud because she was signing for all payments she received. She also had a written contract providing for the commissions. So there wasn't a concealment of the fraud. The evidence of her knowledge of the ongoing fraud by Reese was not overwhelming, since there was active concealment by Reese of his illegal activity, and Ms. Ramos did not share in the profits. And it's the concealment, knowledge, and profits which are used to determine the strength of the case on the element of willfulness. But thank you.
All right, thank you. Ms. Hayden, you're from the government.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Morning.
I guess I'll go backwards and start with the last argument. With regards to the closing argument, which is under the plain error standard of review, the prosecutor's argument was in direct response to defense argument that the government did not have to show that Ramos specifically intended to violate the specific statute. So the government just went back to the jury instruction and basically recited the jury instruction to the jury, stating this is what the law is, but what I say isn't the law, what the court says is the law. So basically the prosecutor also gave the cautionary instruction that the court also emphasized, that do not rely on the attorney's statements, rely on what I say the law is. But the government did, or the prosecutor did, recite the actual charge and explaining that what the definition of willfulness was, that you have to have a bad purpose with the intent to disregard or disobey the law. But under Starks and under Davis and under the Fifth Circuit precedent for in the purposes of anti-kickback statute, willfulness does not require that they had to have knowledge of the specific statute. Also, when it was amended in 2010, the congressional report shows the same thing, that they clarified and codified the Fifth Circuit and other majority views that you don't have to violate the specific statute. Know that you're violating a specific statute, that it's sufficient to show that the standard willfulness definition, that you had the specific purpose to do something with a bad purpose.
What is the measure of knowledge that's, I mean, we know, as you just said, it's something less than actual knowledge, but what is the level?
Your Honor, I believe in the United States versus Davis, which is the Fifth Circuit case that discussed this, it would be knowledge doing something voluntarily and purposefully, knowing the actions, the conduct that you're committing, which is accepting a kickback or a commission for referring someone in the Medicare program for an item, for a durable medical equipment, and with the, you know, with specific intent to do something that the law either, with a bad purpose, with either the specific intent to do something the law forbids or something in disregard of the law. So, in other words, there is a bad purpose. You know that what you're doing is probably against the law. You know, in it probably requires knowledge that you're either disregarding the law or you're disobeying the law. But you don't have to have the specific knowledge of what the anti-kickback statute states. And like the court, the 11th Circuit in United States versus Starks pointed out, it's not the type of statute that's hyper-technical that could embrace innocent conduct. It's the type of conduct that one would know is not proper and it's probably illegal in accepting commissions for referring Medicare patients, which really distinguishes between an independent contractor and an employee, because an independent contractor is paid based on his referrals, not just based on his employment. An employee gets paid regardless. An independent contractor gets paid based on the number of referrals. And it all goes back to the purpose of the anti-kickback statute to begin with, and that is to, you know, prevent fraud, to make sure that the durable medical equipment that's being, you know, prescribed and billed for is something that really is necessary, and that it's something that's in the patient's best interest. In other words, a patient goes to a doctor and a doctor prescribes it, not a marketer coming to you and asking that you purchase this item and then doing it backwards, basically. So that's what occurred in this case. And again, with the closing argument, it was under the plain error standard of review, and because of the cautionary instructions, because of the strength of the evidence, because the prosecutor was responding to defense arguments, for all the reasons cited in the brief, there is no plain error for the closing arguments. And going back to St. Junius's argument, dealing with the manager, organizer, the three-level enhancement, there was a lot of evidence that showed that she was a manager. If you look at all of the evidence and the testimony that was credited by the jury of the accomplices or the co-conspirators who pled guilty, she signed all the paychecks, she paid the recruiters, she supervised others in billing and how to bill, what codes to put on the billing. She was the second only to Reese as to the amounts that she received from the fraud. She received up to 7% of all the monies paid by Medicare for her own personal benefit. She's the one, like Judge, the court pointed out, that received the Rolls Royces and the Bentleys and the $800,000 house. She benefited tremendously. And Reese, the co-defendant, even though he testified for the defense, testified that he trained her to be the owner, to take over that business. The
so
fact
is
that
the government's position that she is the main leader or just a manager within the organization?
I think if the government's position is Reese was the organizer. He's the one that, you know, set it up. He's the one that probably gave a lot of the advice and was definitely behind TMS. And I'm sorry, the mobility store, I refer to as TMS in the brief. But he did this before in a previous company. He had someone else on the application because he had a long criminal history and couldn't be on there himself. But
so you don't have to be the top person to get the 3 points.
The 3 points. You have to supervise one person. She supervised more than one person by paying the recruiters, being the go-to person when Lopez was not there. Lopez was the office manager. She was the face to Medicare and Medicaid. Whenever there was a problem, she was the one that the Medicare and Medicaid representatives talked to, corresponded with through documentation and letters. She spoke with them on the phone for the mobility store. So she was also the face of the business for purposes of the fraud. I mean, it could not have been it could not have occurred other than her acting as the owner, because Reese could not be the owner, and so she really allowed for. Without her, the fraud could not have occurred. And with regards to the deliberate ignorance instruction, the defense centered on the fact that she was only a clerk. Even though the evidence showed, we believe the evidence showed otherwise. We believe the evidence was raised with regards to whether she purposely contrived to avoid looking at certain things. But it also raised actual knowledge. I mean, there was substantial evidence of actual knowledge. And under a plain error standard of review for giving this particular instruction, harmless error has been shown when there's substantial evidence of knowledge. But in this case, the defense did center on her lack of knowledge. And the government's position was that she received lots of correspondence and questions from Medicare and Medicaid representatives asking, you know, you've shown us all of this stuff on the documentation showing that you're the only owner, but we're receiving information that Reese and Lopez are also involved in management at your company. And they would inquire about a number of things that were in violation of the Medicare policies and regulations. She would be the one that would respond, you know, to the allegations. So the response would be that if she did not know about the Medicare and Medicaid regulations, she certainly purposely did not try to find out, even when Medicare and Medicaid was inquiring and asking her. So for her to come back and say, you know what, I was only a clerk, I didn't really know everything, well, certainly the letters, correspondence, and inquiries put her on notice, and someone would, at that point, make do something to find out. And she, if we believe that she did not, then certainly she did. She consciously disregarded or chose not to, is the government's position.
When this was begun, I mean, the theory being it was put in her name because of Reese's past history, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, in the startup, the program doesn't ask for the names of, like, all the people who are going to be involved, yada, yada, yada.
It does, Your Honor. And the application asks for anybody who has 5% or more ownership in the company, and also someone who has a management, you know, role in the company, and Reese definitely had both. He received 20% or more of all the payments from Medicare and Medicaid.
Well, I mean, I'm just
and
curious.
Control the accounts.
I'm just curious because he's listed and because, you know, he has his history. It's just strange to me that there's not an alert, you know, a red flag, something, you know, here that this goes on for as long as it does when, you know, I mean, he's named there. I mean, I guess I'm likening it to put it in context, you know, where we are here, you know, you come through the border and there's somebody with a prior history, there's a flag, there's an alert, you know, you go to secondary, et cetera, et cetera. So these papers have his name on it and they've got him in the computer as a previous, you know,
in response to that, Your Honor, his name was not on the paperwork. That was the issue. They purposely kept his name off of everything.
But he had the ownership interest, right?
Well, he had the ownership.
But in none of the papers is he listed, you know, as an owner. I guess that's the part I got through. I know he wasn't listed to run it, but I thought his ownership interest or somehow for him to get the money, he was listed. So, no?
No, Your Honor, he was not. Now, with all the paperwork with Medicare and Medicaid, they purposely... in fact, when they inquired about whether he did have some sort of interest, St. Junius would reply back that he did not have any interest, ownership interest.
Okay.
The way we describe him as the owner is he controlled the accounts. There was 14 accounts that were related and received monies from the Medicare and Medicaid. He was signatory on all of them. He received the most of the money. St. Junius received the second most of the money from the fraud. The people that worked at the business knew that he was really, you know, acting or was the one controlling things. But as far as Medicare and Medicaid, they purposely kept them from knowing that. That's why he used St. Junius was the one that was described as the owner. And that's really how she effectuated and how they all effectuated the fraud. They had to have someone on there that so that they could get the provider number. Medicare would not have allowed this business to be approved as a provider if they had known that Reese had any involvement in it. There was already another business of his that had been shut down with his wife who was the person listed as the owner. As soon as that was shut down, then they opened up the mobility store. But St. Junius was there regularly. The people that worked there knew what she was involved in. They said she knew about the billings. She knew that, you know, they would bill for products that really weren't being provided, that they were providing billing codes that were not the proper billing codes, that doctors' prescriptions were not really being obtained, that the patients were not authorizing the billings, that, you know, they did not sign off on them billing under their Medicare numbers. All of these things were pervasive at this company. There's really no evidence that anything legal occurred here, that it was pretty much all fraudulent.
How old was she? She was still a very young person at that moment.
She was in her 20s, Your Honor.
Okay. I mean, was this her first job? Did she have any experience working in this line of business before?
Your Honor, I don't know that answer. It's not really in the record. I do know that, I mean, there was ample evidence that the jury found to convict her. They're not really challenging the sufficiency on appeal. She was intricately involved, and but for her involvement, they couldn't have perpetrated the fraud. Medicare, she was the face to Medicare, and she also played a prominent role at the business, and she controlled the assets. She and Reese had their names on all the accounts. She had to sign off on things because she was the account holder of the 14 bank accounts that the mobility store held. So she acted as, you know, someone who would be the owner in everything that she did. And she benefited. I mean, she benefited tremendously. I mean, the cars that they purchased, $300,000 cars, she probably owned three or four of those. And they would have it for a year or two, and they'd go trade in and get another one. And that's part of the money laundering, how they would effectuate the money laundering as well. And they went to, you know, a check cashing place, and a lot of times would pay their personal expenses through cashing checks through the Money Stop. And that was done by St. Junius as well as Reese, which was another way to launder the funds and to hide the fact that they were really using the business monies that came in for their personal benefit. And she was the second to benefit, only second to Reese himself. So that's the reason why, I mean, she got the three-level enhancement for having a manager role, and she also abused the trust with Medicare in her role as the owner, as well as, you know, she knew she was obtaining information without authorization by the Medicare patients. So she also received identifying information under the enhancement for abuse of trust, where you receive, you know, information like Medicare information and other personal information without authorization. And with regards to, Spicer, Your Honors, the government does agree that with regards to the restitution being a condition of the supervised release, that it should be remanded because it was not limited to the counts of conviction for restitution purposes. And the government would submit that looking at the definition of victim under the restitution statutes, that it would be the amount that was proximately caused by the specific billings in the counts of conviction, which would be the amounts that were paid by Medicare on the claims for the patients that were referred by the by Spicer, because that would be, but for him referring the patients, the Medicare would not have paid on those claims. And with regards to the amount of loss, I'm sorry, was there a question? With regards to the amount of loss, again, this is plain error. In the district court below, there was no question that the court knew the proper standard, as opposed to some of the other cases where it was sent back because it was not an Izzo-Wheely. They sent it back because it wasn't, you know, they were not sure whether the court exercised the right standard. Here, the standard was placed right in front of the court and right in front of the parties. The defendant had the ability to object at that point. He did not. He had the ability to controvert the evidence or controvert that position by providing specific information. All the information we have with regards to his brief is that he was not familiar with the Medicare billing procedures, as opposed to someone who is involved in the billing and would know the caps and the fixed payments by Medicare. So in this case, he admits on appeal that he did not know. So it falls right into the cases cited by the government where if they do not know the specific amounts, then you would go with the amount that was billed, unless they show otherwise. And he has not shown otherwise. And because he had the ability to do that below, he should not be given a second bite at the apple. I mean, he had the ability. The courts brought it to the... I mean, the government brought it to the court's attention. The probation brought it to the court's attention. He had the chance to respond. He had the chance to object, and he did not. But nonetheless, also, in this case, the court made it very clear that he had a specific sentence in mind for both Ramos and Spicer. And the court stated, I want everyone to know, I've heard all the evidence. I've considered everything in the PSR, and I believe that Ramos and Spicer should both receive the same sentence because they committed similar crimes in a similar manner, and he sentenced both Ramos and Spicer to 60 months, the statutory maximum, for the anti-kickback statute. So from the comments, and they were all sentenced at the same proceeding. So the comments that were made by the court made it clear that he had a specific sentence in mind, that he had considered the factors under 3553, that he had considered all the evidence, and that he thought this was the appropriate specific sentence for both defendants. So under the plain error standard of review, because the record shows that the court would have sentenced them to that specific sentence based on all the evidence, regardless of the enhancement, in fact, with Ramos, the court varied upward to outside, you know, to give her guideline sentence that varied upward from the applicable guidelines, stating that this is the what I think is appropriate sentence, 60 months. He sentenced all the defendants to the statutory maximum except for the money laundering conviction. He imposed the statutory the highest level under the applicable sentencing guidelines with regards to St. Junius. So the court did hear, he heard all the evidence, he saw the demeanor of the witnesses, he was able to, you know, to view things that this court can't, and from doing all that, the court determined that those were the appropriate sentences for those three defendants. Thank you, Your Honors. Unless you have any other questions, I rest on my brief.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, rebuttal,
to clarify, do I still have my rebuttal time, or did I use it up on the front end?
No, I gave you an additional 2 minutes to deal with the second issue. You still have your rebuttal.
Super. Thank you, Your Honors. I wanted to clarify. I mentioned earlier that on page 81, I had earlier said it was the April the 12th record, or excuse me, the 13th record. It's actually the April the 12th record, and I think this is a huge fact that really cannot be lost on any of this, is the fact that this agent who did all of the work investigating the case, ferreting out the truth, unraveling the fraud, said in response to the prosecution's questioning on direct examination that St. Junius was only an owner or manager on paper. He's the guy that knew the most. This is the investigator that unraveled the case, and that's his opinion about what occurred.
Well, what do you do with the evidence, though? I mean, even assuming he says that, prosecutors said all this evidence that unfurled in front of the jury, presumably they made the decision based on the evidence as opposed to the case agent's thought. I mean, what do you do with it?
Well, I think that a lot of what the prosecutor is saying is, of course, from the prosecutor's perspective. And in fact, what she says is that St. Junius signed paychecks, supervised billers, received 7 to 8%, got Bentleys, Rolls Royces, and a house. All of these things are not exactly what the evidence said. I mean, she did sign some paychecks as directed by James Reese, but she also, the testimony was clear that she didn't sign everything that purported to have her signature on it. In addition to that, she never supervised any billers. In fact, she was a clerk just like they were, entering codes. And while some of the people that did come to testify said that sometimes we were able to ask St. Junius for help with the system, it was as if stepping, maybe if you're a teller at Target, to the next counter and asking, how do I enter this price tag? That was the nature of the questions that were asked. And the property was all given to James Reese. It was the Bentleys, the house, were all ostensibly done by James Reese, but they were put in her name because he had bad credit. And looks like I'm out of time, unless I have any other questions that I can answer.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Frizzell.
Your Honors, with respect to the government's position on loss calculation, we would suggest that in this case, again, as I argued originally, it's critical to point out that Mr. Spicer's case can be distinguished from the cases cited by the government in making a loss calculation, and that he is not the one who was billing, submitting bills to Medicare. It was Mr. Reese. In virtually all, if not all, of the cases cited by the government, the defendant himself or herself was the person who was submitting the bills to Medicare, and that's a critical distinction in this case. The government points out that Mr. Spicer has argued and that was testified or shown at trial that he was not familiar with the reimbursement schedules used by Medicare. Now, the government takes the position that would argue in favor of hitting him with the entire $1.5 million amount that was billed by Mr. Reese. But in this case, because Mr. Spicer is not the one who was billing, it's our position that it is relevant to determining his subjective intent. As I argued earlier, under Sanders, the government has to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that Mr. Spicer had the subjective intent to cause a loss of $1.5 million.
Did Mr. Spicer present any evidence at the sentencing hearing to counter this allegation of the amount?
Well, he did file objections, Your Honor, to the PSR, and the objections are noted. He did object to the calculation of being $1.5 million. I'd like to point out that a reading of the sentencing transcript will show that virtually all objections, in fact, were overruled summarily, and it appears from a reading of the transcript that he wasn't given an opportunity. And he did suggest an alternative damage amount calculation, and that was the $71,120 that he received from Mr. Reese. So he did preserve the error. He did suggest an alternative calculation. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Frizzell.
The government, I want to respond to the government's argument that the prosecutor's statements during closing argument were invited argument. Spicer's counsel stated that Spicer did not have the specific, in closing argument, said that Spicer did not have the specific intent to violate the statute. Ramos's counsel argued that Ramos did not know that it was illegal or unlawful to receive commissions. Even if the statement that Spicer did not have specific intent to violate the statute is an incorrect argument under the willfulness element, it does not invite a misstatement of the law by the prosecution. It, at best, it invites the prosecution to state the proper standard of their burden of proof.
All right. Thank you. Ms. DeBord and Mr. Frizzell, you are both court-appointed. The court deeply appreciates your valiant service on behalf of your clients, accepting these cases, filing the briefing, and certainly coming to provide argument to us on behalf of your clients. We thank you and all others who take on this very important task.
Thank you,
thank you to all counsel. The case will be submitted.